God, please set aside everything I think I know about myself, my disease, these steps, and especially you, for an open mind and a new experience with myself, my disease, these steps, and especially you. I believe tonight we're on Clean House.
Sounds good.
And without further ado, the dynamic duo of Jules and Robbie.
That medication gets me every time. Hi guys, I'm Robbie, recovered alcoholic. Hi, it's so good to see everyone again. It's so nice of them to come back again after us for a couple of weeks, huh? So we're going to talk about... I'm sorry, and this is Jules.
Hi, everyone.
Who are you?
Hi, I'm Jules, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Jules.
So we're going to talk about cleaning house tonight. And we're going to just warn you. Do you have enough coffee, though, now?
Yeah,
you good?
Yeah.
All right. We got stuck in some traffic tonight. We didn't get to bring up coffee, so I don't know how this is going to go. We'll wing it. We'll do our best. And we partied last night. We're kind of hungover a little bit. We're not sure what that is. We're not. I think it's age for me. I don't know what Jules' thing is. It can't be age for her, but it was Jules' birthday, so happy birthday to Jules.
Happy birthday.
Thank you.
So she had a party yesterday, and we had a good time. But I woke up today like, I can't move. And I think the party was over by like 10, wasn't it?
No.
I don't know what's happening now. I could barely get up to come here. So we're going to... I'm going to wing this again, but we're going to talk about, we went over trusting God and what that looks like, and now we're going to talk about cleaning house and why that's necessary and some of our experiences with it, and talk about some of my experience with that, and then we're going to get into, helping others and that continuous process of trusting God. You want to start, Jules?
You can start. This is fun.
All right, we're going to go to page 63 where it says, next we launched. So clearly it doesn't say next we slowly get there, we take a break, we work on this stuff for 4 or 5 months, stuff like that. You hear all the time. You know, it's that time that we'll take a break and I'm writing my fourth step is what we hear all the time. And obviously we lose a lot of girls in that process. I've seen, you know, quite a few go out and die and quite a few girls that don't never come back while they're taking their time to launch. You know, well, that gets a little confused and washed down somewhere along the way. And they're out there writing. It doesn't take that long. So it's right after we just said this third step prayer and now we have this new power that we've tapped into and we're going to launch into rigorous action. Jules, do you want to? That's my slow to start.
Right. Okay. So we made this decision last time, right, that we were going to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God, as we understood Him, and we said that third step prayer, and so that's a really great decision, but it doesn't really mean a whole lot unless there's some action behind it. And the first step in that, you know, because we've been discussing this whole time about how we want to grow closer to our higher power, our Creator. And in order to do that, we kind of have to clear away some things in order to make that connection a little bit more clear. So the first step in action for that would be the fourth step, taking a personal inventory. And this is the first time we're actually asked to sit down and, like, do actual work. And I think that's kind of ironic that that's the place where we lose people is where they have to start doing something.
We talked about that last week. We have to do a lot of work to not do what we already don't want to do. You know what I mean? I don't know about you, but I so didn't want to do it for a long time before I came in here. And now there's all this work that's involved in just getting to not do what I already don't want to do. And I don't know how you guys were when you came in, but I wasn't real interested in all that stuff going on over here. There was a lot of math involved. It looked like 24 things, and I have no idea what was on that side. And I wasn't interested in much action. I wasn't interested in little action. It had nothing to do with this at all. And I wasn't looking into getting into this, you know, rigorous honesty and swallowing huge chunks of truth about self. And, you know, that was all just crazy talk. I'm just still trying to get some free coffee and a couch to sleep on. Mm-hmm. And that's all I'm looking for, and hook up with you for a minute. And you guys kept talking about this work that was required. It was required in order to have a spiritual awakening. It was required. They started telling me about how these meetings that we come to tonight and these meetings that we join in church basements all over the country and all over the world, that they're really just a support fellowship for people that have gone through the work which is required in order to join this fellowship. We meet and we talk about that. But I'm just trying to hang out, you know, suffering from untreated alcoholism, just trying to hang out and not have to hear that conversation. Mm-hmm. And what Jewel said is it's backed up on the top of 64 where it says, through our decisions was a valid and crucial step. It could have little and permanent effect unless once followed by a strenuous effort to face and to be rid of the things in ourselves which had been blocking us. Our liquor or crack cocaine, whatever it was but a symptom. We had to get down to the causes and conditions.
Yep. Yeah, because when past couple weeks, when we defined what alcoholism is and what it isn't, we've already established that that's not really the problem. So what is the problem? It's ourselves. So it says in the next paragraph, therefore we started upon a personal inventory. This was step four. And it says, taking a commercial inventory is a fact-finding and fact-facing process. So it's not therapy. We're really going to be mean to you about it, but you're probably not going to feel very good after you do it because you're seeing exactly who and what you are in black and white. Like, I know I didn't, and I still don't. Like, once a year we try to sit down and go through a formal written inventory, and afterwards I'm like, oh, God, I'm still messing this whole thing up, and I'm just so terrible. And, you know, because I can't be objective in my own life. Like, I can, whatever the situation is, I can kind of manipulate it and make it be okay in some way or work out in my favor. So I need someone else who's not emotionally involved in my life or attached to any of the outcomes to tell me, like, nope, totally wrong, can't do that. And when we talk about, the first thing we look at is resentments. The bottom of 64 says, resentment is the number one offender. It destroys more alcoholics than anything else. From it stems all form of spiritual disease, for we have been not only mentally and physically ill, we have been spiritually sick. So when I have a resentment, there's this saying that says, holding on to a resentment is like holding on to a hot coal. Like, I'm the only one getting hurt. You know, if I'm resentful at somebody, it just takes over my head, and I just, for days and days, I'll just sit in it like, oh, like I can't do anything else without thinking about it, and I'm so mad, and it just blocks my connection with you, with my higher power, with everything. And, you know, it says in here, I think it's on the next page, about was it 68, where resentment is, resentment is to die, or whatever. Like, mm-hmm. Resentment is to drink is to die.
For us to drink is to die.
Yeah.
And it talks about that. And
mm-hmm. Yeah.
Can you tell we're tired?
Yeah.
So it talks about what Jules just read. It says that we're diseased, and for me, I couldn't get down with the whole disease model of this. I thought it was still an argument. The argument's kind of over. It's been done and said, and we've moved past that in Alcoholics Anonymous. But I couldn't really get with that. So my sponsor had me just break down that word to being a diseased. I was just uncomfortable. I was just not at ease. I just couldn't get into a comfortable spot. I really had never felt any kind of comfortability. I didn't know what that looked like. I saw you guys looking comfortable, where you're sitting, the people you're talking to, where you're standing. You just seemed okay there. You just seemed comfortable with all that. And I just couldn't get out of that discomfort. I couldn't get out of that dis-ease that I was constantly in a state of. And I had to look at that and look at that where we had been spiritually sick and the malady that Jules just talked about. So, you know, and like, I don't know exactly, like, at this point, I don't know what this disease is. I don't know what I suffer from, and I don't know what how this is going to look on paper. but I'm full of fear, and those resentments have been cropping up since I was old enough to crawl. I was so pissed off at the world, right? The thing is, when we start to clean house and we do 4 and 5, you kind of can't be in self-pity anymore. It kind of doesn't work like that. And Jules has talked about, like, when we do our annual house cleaning, she doesn't always feel good afterwards. And the book tells us that we go home and we thank God for that we know him better. And that's us being on, you know, it's just rocketing into a state of complete grace. Just going home and having some kind of faith that I know God better. I don't know that I do know God better, but I'm going to thank him for that. And that's what we call faith. Thinking ahead and something I can't even see, that because of this process of cleaning house, I now know him better. And so I have to, we talked earlier the first week about, I don't know how you guys were born, but I was born with this black cloud, and it was right over me, about 4 feet above me, right around here, and it just followed me everywhere I went, and it just rained self-pity all over me, and I just felt like I just gotta go, I'm so uncomfortable, and I just feel so icky, and I didn't have any better word for it. I couldn't tell you about this malady and a spiritual sickness. All I could tell you is I feel so icky inside. And it just doesn't feel good. I just don't know how to get out of this. And that's that malady that I'm constantly trying to fill, find something to fill that and feel better about. It's that ickiness that I'm trying to get away from. And because that self-pity, once I did a thorough and honest fourth and fifth step with my sponsor, the self-pity just went away. That black cloud was just the wind took it away. I didn't know anything about that, but the self-pity, because what I had was a complete change in perception, which is the whole point of house cleaning, is to have, like Jules has said, to have a new perspective on things. For somebody to be able to point out that last column to me, because it's all about finding that last column. I have a sponsor now, when we do house cleaning, we take that last column, just move it over to the first column, because all I'm really resentful about is that last column anyway. All I'm really pissed off the world about is what I've done, the choices I made, and the places I put myself in a position to be harmed for. That's all it really is. But I can't see that. You know what I mean? And we talk about, we hear people talking about doing a fifth step, and they just can't wait to dump all that garbage onto another human being. That's got nothing to do with what we're doing in a fifth step. We're trying to get a new perspective on this. We're trying to get a new angle, to see where I've been selfish and dishonest and self-seeking and full of fear my entire life, and where I've been wrong and put myself in this position, and how I can move past that and out of that last column and hold my own feet to the fire and move past that.
Mm-hmm. And the book gives us really specific instructions on how we're to do this inventory. It says we set them on paper, so we already know we have to start writing stuff down. We listed people, institutions, or principles with whom we are angry. So a lot of us like to use those sheets with the columns. So the first column is like, who or what I'm angry with? And then we put it on the sheet. And it could be an idea. It could be a concept. And sometimes people ask me, like, well, I'm not sure if this is a resentment. A resentment is anger played over and over and over again in your mind. Like, it just consumes everything. Like, if you think about it, your blood starts boiling, and you're like, oh, my God, I got to cut me off on the highway, him. Mm-hmm. So you,
or just anybody you want to send a Christmas card to.
Right. I forget what I was saying. But it's really important to go down the column and don't go across, because the next one is why. So if I sit down and write, I'm resentful at, let's say, my mom, and then I write in the second column why, I could be there for a day writing a novel, and I'll just make myself even more mad thinking about it and going through the whole thing again over and over in my mind. So we just go down the column, everybody that we're resentful at, and then the next one is why. And then the next part is, because typically when we have the resentment, it's because something within us is being hurt or threatened. And they talk about the major, like the needs of a human being, which is usually like money.
Prestige. Security.
Yeah. Is that all of them? Yeah, three. Really not with it today.
What? What was that?
What?
I thought somebody
She's
had another one.
Seven off.
Oh.
Oh. Oh.
Okay.
So, usually one of those things is affected, and that's why we have the resentment. So then they usually, we ask ourselves, it says, in most cases, we found that it was our self-esteem, our pocketbooks, our ambitions, our personal relationships, including sex, that were hurt or threatened. So we were sore. We were burned up. So typically, if one of those things is being affected, that's why we were angry. And then the end of it is looking like, where was I wrong? Because every resentment I've ever had, I did something. Like, I did something to cause a reaction in another human being, and then I wasn't happy with their reaction. So, and then I get mad. And I haven't heard, I think I've only ever heard one thing that there was nothing, like childhood trauma, things like that. Didn't do anything to provoke that, but everything else, there's always a part that we play in it. So there's really no, like, getting off easy.
Right.
There's no free tickets.
And today, the house cleaning, the inventory for me typically looks something like this. I've assigned you a role, mm-hmm. and you have not lived up to it. And now I'm pissed off at you for that.
Yep.
And that's pretty much what that looks like. I've assigned you a role, and I've not given you a job description, but how dare you not fulfill your job accordingly to my expectations of you. And that's typically what my resentments stem from. It typically looks something like that. Fancied or real, true or false. I can't differentiate it. I get stuck into that behavior of how you would constantly affect me, right? We talked about this last week too. I can live in a state, in a spirit of calmness and that just being and stillness and feel the connection with the source and the power and the energy, and I choose to call God. I can live in that state until you piss me off and I get resentment. That's it. Right? Like, I'm not, it turns out that I still suffer from this human condition. Sober or not, you know, suffering from untreated alcoholism or not, married or not, it doesn't, you know, all those things, this or that, doesn't matter. I have the human condition, and those, I want to say that just doesn't happen anymore, but it does. You know, I suffer from this human condition where I fall short, and I get pretty pissed off at you for that, typically. And so that's why we do nightly inventory, and we'll get to that later. But, you know, that's about that whole constantly going to another human being, as it tells us to do, and discuss this so that can be pointed out to me. Mm-hmm. And giving somebody else spiritual permission to do that. See, that was huge for me. I went through 13 sponsors before I did my fifth step. And 13, at the 13th one, my friends were like, come on, this is ridiculous. Like, just tell the taxi cab driver, do something. And I actually went to, and I'll tell you a quick little story, because Jules is so good at the mechanics and everything, and I'll just tell you stories about that. But I was so full of fear with this fifth step thing. I just wasn't tapped into any kind of relief from that at this point. And I went to a place in Walla Walla, Washington. I think they say so good, they named it twice, something like that. And, to a bikers, an Alki Angels, all reformed Hales Angels that were now recovered alcoholics. Aww. And they're called the Alki Angels, and they had a bike rally in Walla Walla, Washington. I packed up my bags. Lula's laughing at me. I packed up my bags and I drove to this place where I clearly would know nobody there. And and I went into a meeting out in the campgrounds and around this pig roast and fire they were having. I mean, I like pulled up and just walked into this circle and just said, excuse me, I know there's a meeting going on here, but I got to do a fist up or I'm going to die. And they were like, oh, okay. And any volunteers? And a couple women raised their hands, and a woman said, listen, I do a lot of these fist ups. Let's go take a walk. And I had my inventory with me because I was about to fire my 14th sponsor. I couldn't look her in the eye. I just had this fear that was paralyzing, and I still get chills. I don't know why, because it was just so real and raw to me at the time, where I didn't know if I had what it took, that kind of courage, to be able to do this inventory. And so I did it with a stranger for the first time, and the rest of that story is funny. I'll tell you guys over coffee sometime. But but when I got back, I told my sponsor I did my fifth step, and we moved on, you know, we just moved on, and that was okay with her. And the book talks about that, that can look like a lot of different things to you, and that's okay. And then later, you know, we got to a point where I could do my fist up with her, and that's great.
Mm-hmm. And I think that it's such a it's something that a lot of people don't get to do. Like, it's a really good opportunity for self-introspection. Like, I don't know too many people that don't live this way of life, like people who aren't in a 12-step program or live by that do any form of self-introspection. And a lot of times, like, there are situations that they just can't even handle. And I think it's just a beautiful way to teach us, like, how to communicate with other people better. Like, if we're looking at what's our part in it, and it says, at the bottom of 65, it says, the first thing apparent was that this world and its people were often quite wrong. Right, I don't agree with everything that everybody says and does. But it says, to conclude that others were wrong was as far as us, as most of us ever got. And I know so many people that that's all they can do. Well, they're just wrong. Okay, well, I think this is just such a beautiful way to teach us, like, well, maybe we should adapt better and have better communication skills. Like, if I know, like, it just teaches us how to deal with people better, because we're constantly looking at, like, how can I change to meet your needs a little bit better, and just get rid of all this anger. And it says on 66, the second paragraph, it is plain that a life which includes deep resentment leads only to futility and unhappiness.
Hmm.
Well, that sounds terrible. I don't want all that. who wants to be like, no, I don't want to do it now. I want the life of futility and unhappiness.
What's futility mean?
I don't know. What does it mean?
Of no use.
Of no use.
Mm-hmm.
To the precise extent that we permit these, do we squander the hours that might have been worthwhile? Like, it's just such a waste of time. It just darkens my spirit so much. And it says that, but with the alcoholic, whose hope is the maintenance and growth of a spiritual experience, here they're telling us again, but that's the whole point of this. This business of resentment is infinitely grave. We found that it is fatal. That's a pretty serious sentence. For when harboring such feelings, we shut ourselves off from the sunlight of the spirit. The insanity of alcohol returns and we drink again. And with us, to drink is to die. What? Like, this is so important that we do this. If we were to live, we had to be free of anger. The grouse and the brainstorm were not for us. They may be the dubious luxury of normal men, but for alcoholics, these things were poison. We turned back to the list, for it held the key to the future. We were prepared to look at it from an entirely different angle. We began to see the world and its people really dominated us. So they're telling us that we're so ruled by what everybody else is doing and thinking and feeling, and how everything affects me, and it's all about me and my feelings, and you need to change and be nicer to me and treat me different and move out of my way on the highway because I'm in a rush, even though I left 15 minutes late. You know? So, yeah, anything on that, Brad?
No, I think it's a really powerful paragraph. I think it's one of the most powerful passages that we have throughout this book, when it talks about the to drink is to die, because it's a fatal disease, and people really are dying from it. How many people do you know that, you know, ventured out to do this work that's required, and you just never saw them again? We don't know if they made it back, or they didn't make it back, or what happened. And then how many do we know that just hung out in the rooms and never did the work that's required and eventually died from untreated alcoholism? It's a serious disease. We have a lot of fun doing this thing. You know, we're going to go to this Love Ladies, is it called?
Yeah.
Yeah. And we're going to swimming in the beach or something together. Yeah. It's
crazy. The ocean.
In the ocean. And but we have a good time, right? We're all going to barbecues and picnics, and we have a good time. And Jules and I like to goof off and have fun with this. And but when it comes to this stuff here, we got to be serious about it, and we can't water it down at all. We have to tell people the truth, and the truth is for us to drink is to die, and there's no softening that up. That's just the truth of the matter. Is the truth of the matter is, if you can't give somebody permission to tell you the truth and sit down with them and be transparent and honest and see through and be vulnerable, which we talked about last week, it's the hardest thing to do. If you can't do that, you're going to die. And you know, on top of that, you might live a long time miserable.
Oh.
Before you die.
Oh.
But you know what I mean? Like, that's the hard that's the truth of it. And that, and this is where the book, it, you know, tells us the truth, and then it gives us some hope and some solution right after that. It goes into that next, but it gets real and honest with the fact that for us to drink is to die, and to carry those resentments is, and that we have to move to that place of, God, show me where I'm sick. Show me where other people are sick. Get me into that spirit where I can live in a space where I'm looking to see where people are simply just spiritually sick, just as I am. Mm-hmm. And I am. I'm spiritually sick, right? I make mistakes, and like we talked about, I fall off the beam sometimes and stuff like that. But when you do it, how dare you? Right? I don't give you the permission. We suffer from the same disease, but we judge the shit out of each other for it. Right. Doesn't make any sense.
Terrible.
Right? And most of our resentments come from these kind of judgments that we have. Is it, we suffer from the same disease, but when you don't do AA the way I do it, or you don't do inventory the way I do it, whatever it is, your sponsor, my sponsor, and beat up your sponsor kind of thing, we start to get, right? And I was waiting to get Frank to laugh tonight. but you know, all that stuff, all that fluffy stuff, it don't make any sense. And that's the crap that's getting the message watered down. That's the crap that's getting us away from the clear cut instructions and the clear cut directions that are outlined in this book and in the black and on the white page. It's just real simple. And that's what we're trying to do, and we're serious about that stuff, and we should be. We should be qualifying these people, and we should be telling them, you have to do this work, or you're going to die. And that's my little tangent. I'll let you go back to what the book says about that.
Yep, so on the bottom of 66, the boys, oh, jeez.
The boys?
I don't know. The book. the book says, this was our course. We realized that people who wronged us were perhaps spiritually sick, which is exactly what Robin just said. Though we did not like their symptoms and the way they disturbed us, they, like ourselves, were sick too. We asked God to help us show them the same tolerance, pity, and patience we would cheerfully grant a sick friend. When a person offended, we said to ourselves, and this is kind of like the resentment prayer, this is a sick man. How can I be helpful to him? God, save me from being angry. Thy will be done. I just want to make a point to note that this is not like a condescending kind of thing. Like, ow, they're just spiritually sick. So terrible. No. It's supposed to be bringing us to a place of compassion. Like, oh, could you imagine what it could be like to look out of that pair of eyes that you're so upset and mad about, like, who didn't make the coffee right for the meeting? Like, oh my God. Like, just to live in that place, like, what else makes you mad all the time? Like, I don't know about you, I really don't like feeling angry. I don't like it. I don't like to feel angry. I don't like to feel sad, upset, any of that. So it wants to keep us in a place of compassion and understanding, because we were once there too. Like, yeah. I've done plenty of things that weren't very nice to anybody else. Come on now. And then it says, we avoid retaliation or argument. We wouldn't treat sick people that way. If we do, we destroy our chance of being helpful. We cannot be helpful to all people, but at least God will show us how to take a kindly and tolerant view in each and every one. So if I'm coming from that place of compassion, I'm probably not going to react back to you at Walmart when you yell at me. This guy yelled at me at the Acme. I got in the 15 items or less line, and I didn't know. And I'm just putting my things on the whatever it's called. And I didn't know he was talking to me, and he's like, oh my God, you must be retarded. And I'm like, oh, this guy's talking to himself. He must be, I don't know. I get out of here. And then he keeps going on and on and on, and I'm like, and I look at him, and he's like, Blondie, you, I'm talking to you. And I was like, for what reason? And he was like, what is wrong with you? This is the 15 items or less line. And I probably had like 18 items. And I was like, oh, I didn't know. Sorry. And I just like took my stuff and I tried to put it back in the cart and leave. He's like, no, now it's too late. And you're terrible. And he's like yelling at Acme and telling everyone around him like how I've just ruined everything. And I was like, oh my God. Now the old me would have been like, listen, buddy. And I would have had some choice words for him. But I didn't, because I was coming from a place of like love and tolerance that the book talks about. Like, wow. There must be something incredibly urgent going on in his life that he has to buy this newspaper and leave right now. Like, maybe he has to go to the hospital to visit a sick friend or something like that, and they need this newspaper. I don't know, but it could be any old thing. really, but...
And that's what, real quick, this just, and then we'll go right back, but that's what we talk about. Like, if you, if that person that had done that to you was a little boy with a bald head that looked like he had chemo going, therapy going on, and he had cancer and is really sick, and of course he's grouchy, he's had a bad day, he's yelling at the grocery store. He's a little boy, he's sick, he has cancer. Let's treat him with some compassion and some love and care and talk nicely to him. Because we can see that kind of sickness, but when somebody suffers from a spiritual sickness, when I suffer from a spiritual sickness, it's just the same as that cancer patient. We just don't see it. When we don't see the little boy with the hair falling out, we feel sorry for him because he's physically sick. Same kind of deal. We just have to look at other people the same way. Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Yep. So that's the resentment part. And it just reiterates it again. Putting out of our minds the wrongs others had done, we resolutely looked for our own mistakes. Where had we been selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and frightened? And it says, the inventory was ours, not the other man's, which is really important to note. Because sometimes when I dread an inventory, I want to be like, right, I did all of this because they did this, that, and the other thing, so it was kind of warranted. So, nope, that's not what we're trying to do here. So the next part of our formal inventory is going to be fear. And fear really is just an absence of God working in that area of my life. Like, let's say I had a really big fear of spider. I actually had someone...
Or the delusion that God doesn't work in that area of my life.
What?
The delusion that God's not working in that area of our life.
What did I say? Okay. Yeah, or like my ignorance to it. Like, I had somebody tell me that it was a friend, and she said, oh, I have this fear of spiders. And I was like, what? You should, you know, just give that to God. Like, he can handle it. And she said, no, it's too big. Spiders is too big for God, though. You need a new conception of God, like, real quick. You better figure it out. I don't know. And you talk so much better about fear than I do.
Because I have a lot.
No!
It was so funny. My first fifth step with my sponsor, and when it came to fears, I had just listed spiders. And
did you really?
Yeah, I did. I just wrote spiders. And she was like, yeah, we're trying to go a little deeper here than the spiders. I'm like, how deep you want to go? I'm scared to death of them. And she's like, yeah, not what we're talking about here.
No.
And then the list was like this long. And I told you last week, you know, the list always really, year after year, every annual house cleaning I do, my biggest fear would come down to someday having to do this thing without my mom. And that was always my biggest fear, you know. But when I do these spot checks now at my fears, and I think we talked about this last week, you know, it's just showing me how agnostic I'm being, you know. So we constantly have this choice of fear or love, and that's why the book goes into fear. I believe that it's if we can't rid ourselves of that and get into a space of trusting God. Because you can't do both. It's one or the other. They don't go. We can trust God or we can be in fear. It's just your choice. What would it be? It doesn't. You know, it takes as much energy, if not more, to worry and be in fear than it does to just have faith and trust in God. I can worry my little head away over things where I can pray about it. It's the amount of energy. It doesn't matter. But when we talk about, we can have our own conception of God and whatever that looks like, and my conception of God doesn't matter to you, and it shouldn't, and vice versa, it just doesn't matter. When I talk about that God that looks like love and compassion and a state of grace, and that God that's, we were talking about it last night at Jules's party, that feeling you get when you're connected with God where you just feel like you're in love. You don't know exactly who with.
Yeah. I'm in love. I don't know who with.
Jules said to me one time, she was like, we just did some house cleaning stuff, and Jules looked at me and she's like, I just feel like I'm madly crazy, head over heels in love. I just don't know who with.
Yeah.
I'm just like in love. And that feeling, just like loving the whole universe, that kind of feeling, you can have that or you can have fear. It's up to you. Like, for me, I'm very clear, and those are my choices today. I don't know I'm in fear unless I take a look at that and list those out and discuss them with another human being. If I don't go to to Chris and tell him, like, listen, here, or he'll tell me, like, listen, this looks like it's all self-centered, decisions based on self-centered fear all over this. I don't see where God is any of this, right? So you can stay in all that fear, and we can look at those, and like Jules said, we can look at what you think, which is you being agnostic, which means no knowledge of, what you have no knowledge of God working here. What, and these things here with your fears, with my fears, when I list those out, it just means I have no knowledge of God being able to fix these certain things. Mm-hmm. And so how agnostic do I want to be in this program? Can I do God as everything as God as nothing? And when I really look at that, there's no room for fear there. There's no space for it. I can't create a space to live in that kind of constant state of what will happen and what about this and what about that, because there is no such thing as what, if anything. It just all is. And the book tells us, and it starts to teach us later in 10 and 11 and in 12 too, about how to move past that fear, how to be still and be in that space where the fear can just flow through you and back on. And we just sit and we're still for that. And aware of it, and then move past it. And that's living in a state of God is everything, you know, or God is nothing. That's that state that I can't afford to be in anywhere else. I just can't afford to.
Yeah. Well, and I know for me, like, one of my fears, it's like this crippling fear that we kind of know, like, where I'm at, like, if I'm being all, like, willy-nilly on my nightly inventory and, like, my journaling, my spiritual practice and all that kind of stuff, I get this crippling fear of death. Like, I'm just so scared I'm going to die and, like, drop dead and all this crazy stuff. And it comes back to the same thing every time. It's like I'm becoming disconnected. Like, I don't have as much faith and trust in God. It says, 168, we trust... on the paragraph, it's like the second one down, it says, perhaps there's a better way. We think so. For we are now on a different basis, the basis of trusting and relying upon God. We trust infinite God rather than our finite selves. So if I have trust in infinite God, it doesn't matter if I drop dead. Like, I'm 27 years old, I'm in perfect health, like, it's highly unlikely anyway. But if I were, like, oh, it's God's will. Like, stop trying to manage it. Like, I really don't have a whole lot to say over, you know, when I expire. It's not really, I don't really play a huge part in it. It says, we're in the world to play the role he assigns. Just to the extent that we do as we think he would have us and humbly rely upon him, he does enable us to match calamity with serenity. So when I'm coming from that place of fear, like, I don't do much very well at all. Like, I'm like, oh no, something's gonna happen, we can't go out, like, it's really, it gets crazy. And everybody kind of knows too, they're like, Jules, you haven't been doing the journaling. I'm like, nope. So, and then it says too, we never apologize to anyone for depending on our Creator. We can laugh at those who think spirituality is the way of weakness. Paradoxically, it is the way of strength. The verdict of the ages is that faith means courage. All men of faith have courage. They trust their God. We never apologize for God. Instead, we let him demonstrate through us what he can do. We ask him this is the prayer. We ask him to remove our fear and direct our attention to what he would have us be. At once we commence to grow fear. So if I'm asking God, you know, just remove this fear, like, help me stay better connected to you so I don't get this crippling fear of death because it's ridiculous. And, like, put my attention to what you would have me be. I'm, like, instantly matched with calamity. Oh, God. With serenity. Instantly. Like, it instantly brings me back. All I have to do is be like, all right, you know what? I'm getting crazy, and I just go sit in meditation or whatever. And then usually my thoughts tend to turn to somebody I could help.
Is really ultimately the only thing. I don't know about your experience. My experience is that's really the only thing that's going to get me out of it anyway. All I can do is be transparent and honest and tell the truth about what my fear is, acknowledge that that's being agnostic, not trusting God, and then simply turn my thoughts to somebody that I can help. And that's the only thing that's going to move me past it anyway. I can sit in that space for a long time, or I can just launch into that space of who can I help. And like Jules read in the previous page, I think on 67, where it says that... it says, we cannot be helpful to all people, but at least God will show us how to take a kindly and tolerant view of each and every one. and it talks about God will show us when and where, and it says how can we be helpful. So the book later, somewhere in the stories, I'm not real well versed in the stories, but talks about if we pray for another human being for, what is it, 10 days or 14 days or something like that, it says in the stories, that's what we do when we have a resentment towards somebody else, and when we don't like someone or whatever, we pray for them for 12 or 14 days. And my experience is I can pray for him for like 185,000 days, and I will still not like you if I don't do something about it. Because it also says, I mean, that's true. I pray for them for 12, 14 days. It'll change my spirit about that a little bit. It'll never go away if I don't take action. So it says faith without works is dead. That means I have to take some action. And what does that look like? It means I have to be helpful. It says that we pray and we ask God how we can be helpful to him, not just pray that they not show up at that meeting, because I really don't like that meeting when they're there. But pray, how can I be helpful to them? And amazing things happen and shift in the universe when that happens. We've done, you know, some pretty cool things that I don't probably need to talk about from the podium, but just some pretty, you know, amazing experiences that have touched me deeply, and I've watched you guys do amazing things that have touched me deeply, and people that have upset me greatly and drop off groceries on their front door to know if you need anything else, how can we help with that? Suddenly makes me feel like I'm in love with them and in love with the world again when they've done nothing. Nobody ever has to do anything for me to feel better. No, you don't have to do anything. My resentment's towards you because I don't like you. You don't have to change. I have to change. And how do I do that? Do something to help you. Do something of love and kindness that gets me back into that space. And that's how we move through that. And God shows us when and where is what the point was to that paragraph is. He constantly shows me, and we talk about balance and how do I get this balance, and it don't matter. I just do whatever is put in my path in front of me that flows like a hot knife through butter, and we just go with it because God's going to continuously show me where and when and how, and all I have to do is not decide what is more important or less important to God. Just let him show me where. And so anyway, back to that fear piece with that is, you know, it's just all about, do I want to live in a constant state of grace? Do I want to live, you know, in that space that I'd like to share with you, which is we're giving out this energy and vibration of happiness and light and compassion that Jules talked about, or do I want to just hide in the darkness? We're always going towards one or the other. And we can talk about that we're going towards a drink or away from a drink. I hear people talking about that. I don't know what that looks like, but I'm either going towards walking in the sunlight of the spirit or I'm going towards the darkness. And when I'm full of fear, which means I'm not trusting in a power greater than myself, I'm going towards that darkness. And that darkness causes me to do things against my own good judgment. That kind of darkness where the fear sets in, I will do things that don't look good on paper, and they don't look good to any normal person, but I do them based on fear, you know, and that's why these resentments and fears are, it never says that we have to get rid of Jack Daniels or whiskey or even crack cocaine. It says that we must get rid of these resentments and that they're going to kill us, and fear puts me back in that icky place. That's just all I know. It puts me back in that place where I don't want to feel like this. What am I going to do? And prayer and meditation and sitting in that silence is the only place to get out of that. And then helping somebody else. Faith without works is dead. How can I be helpful to another human being? How can I turn my thoughts to somebody that can help? And it tells us later, and we'll go back to it real quick, but it tells us later in step 10, so once we've gotten rid of all this house cleaning, we've done all this work, we've gotten back on the beam is love, it tells us how do we stay undisturbed. So if we're not at complete disease anymore, we're not disturbed anymore, how do we stay there? We have to do certain steps and formulas that tells us to do that, and it tells us that we watch for them to creep up because fear is going to creep up. Because self-centeredness and insecurities and all these things are going to creep back up. And what do we do? We watch for them. And it says that we ask God first to remove them. We discuss it with another human being at once. And then we resolutely turn our thoughts to somebody that we can help. So that's our formula. We do all that house cleaning and four and five, but then to stay in that state and to stay in that being, that's what we're doing on a regular basis. Watching for it to creep up, asking God to remove it, discussing with another human being at once, and then turning my thoughts to somebody who can help. When I turn away from me and into you, I am always okay. There is no fear involved in how I can be of usefulness and helpfulness to you. There's just not. There's nothing that creeps in and blocks me. That sky is just a crystal clear blue. Nothing when I turn away from me and into you. I cannot like myself real quickly. I spend a lot of time with all this stuff that's going on with me. The idea is, this whole idea, the deal is to just get away from this. It's about freedom. And we talked about this the last couple of weeks, but it's all about freedom. This entire process is about freedom. And it's freedom from me. And so clearing myself of the resentments and the fears and the wreckage and the shame and the remorse and the guilt and all those stuff that keeps me trapped inside of me in that kind of bondage, it's freedom away from me, not to me or for me. It's not freedom for me, it's freedom for you. You don't want me in a state like that, right? It's freedom from me, and I get that from turning to you.
Mm-hmm. All right, so are we good on fear for all?
Yeah.
Yeah? Okay. All right, so...
Unless you guys have questions. We haven't had any questions tonight, nothing? Go ahead.
Yeah, BJ, okay. On page 67, I've been perplexed with the one statement here. In the middle of the page, so the situation has not been entirely our fault. We tried to disregard the other person involved entirely. I don't understand that.
Read it one more time.
Sure, it's on 67, in the middle of the page. Though the situation has not been entirely our fault, we tried to disregard the other person involved entirely.
Sure, right. And your question is just how does that look like?
I don't understand it in the context.
Well, I think they're just speaking to how sometimes it was like, I don't know if you were here last week when I was talking about how I had never said I was wrong to somebody. Or have said I was wrong, like I was wrong and I'm sorry, but it's your fault, right? It's kind of like that. I've said that before doing a 9-step. I have told you I was wrong. It's just that you shouldn't have left your keys out. I wouldn't have sold your car, right? And stuff like that. So I think what we're talking about there is that sometimes other people have a part in that. Clearly, we don't, in every inventory we do, it's not that the other person has never had any part in it at all. You know, you can't play tug of war if you don't pick up that end of the rope. So someone who's on the other end of that argument, that fight, at some point, the point is, which is a cardinal rule, is we don't look at that. We're just not here to look at that. If we can sit down and look how everybody else was at fault in certain situations. I think they call that gossiping. I think they do it at diners. I'm not sure. It's not done with a notebook and a sponsor and a God-reliance, God-trusting process that we're involved in. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does.
So we're just simply saying they may have done something to provoke it. They may have done something to cause it. It's just not my job to look at it. My job here is to fix me and not to fix you. And if I can't go into that in that kind of spirit, it's never going to be right. If I'm still looking at it like this is my part, but this is because of you, it's just never going to get right. You know, so we just have to not look at theirs, hope that maybe if they're in the program, whatever, they have a sponsor, they can look at theirs. It's none of my business what they've done. I've been involved in that business my whole life, and it's gotten me to a lot of self-pity and anger. It's not in that business anymore. You and then you?
Rich alcoholic.
Rich.
Step 4 is his moral inventory, and step 10 is personal inventory.
Mm.
What's the difference?
I was on the clock.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I was thinking, usually we're facing the clock so we can say it. what was your question again?
Step 4 is moral inventory, step 10 is personal inventory. What's the difference?
I don't know. That's a good question.
I would say not much of one. I mean, the inventory they're referring to in the fourth step consists of, like, a formal list of all of our resentments, all of our fears, all of our sexual misconduct, whereas the 10-step inventory is on page 86, and that's... No, that's the 11th step. There's no real formal... It's just kind of like what they're talking about in step 10 is like as things come up, we're addressing them. and we're kind of watching. It's like the watch, ask, turn formula.
One is the daily, and the other one is your entire life.
They're all, well, they kind of all melt together. Like in step 10, they're talking about things that happen in my life on a daily basis that I notice and like make wrong right away. Like if I snap at my coworker, I'm sorry, I shouldn't have done that kind of thing. It's not like a sit down formal situation. The 11th step is the page 86, the at night when we sit back and review our day. And this, the what they're talking about in step 4 is the formal, like the 4 list. I don't know why they chose different language, though. I don't know.
I think it's a lot to do with the fact that in 4, we're looking at our value systems, we're looking at our morals, or what makes up our insights and our personal value systems, our personal, all those things make up, and like it was just saying, like what makes us tick. Like it's looking at what it is inside of us that is made up. this chemistry or whatever you call it that has developed my personal value systems. That's what 4 mm-hmm. is looking at. And in 10, we're looking at more my personal inventory, what I've done.
Yeah.
What actions am I taking? It's kind of like looking at root and branch. In 4, we're looking at the root of it. What's screwed up in your personal value systems? What doesn't make sense in your morale systems? What are you going against your own character? And taking action anyway, and it shows up in these branches up here, but we're trying to dig down to the root of it, mm-hmm. right? And now in 10, we're getting more into the branch of it. Does that make sense? Is that pretty much what we're saying? Okay. Dave, do you have something on that too?
You asked a question?
Yeah.
So my understanding is that the 4th step is how we identify our common manifestations. Common being that I share with you a dilemma, a common problem. And these are the overall things that I need to address in my 4th step.
Mm-hmm.
What happens is I have a spiritual awakening after going through inventory, after making my amends, and after practicing 10, 11, and 12 in my life. And then I have ways that my ego will return, and that's identified in 10. And that's a personal way that my character defects will remanifest.
Okay. Give me an example.
Not an open room. Not an open room.
All right. What was the other question? You had something over here?
Hi, I'm Donna. I'm not
Hi.
But I was just going to comment about, you know, the question the gentleman had about putting out of our minds the wrong that others have
mm-hmm.
done. I find that there is a real paradox there, and when I'm able to own my part of it, it kind of unlocks the anger that I have for the other person.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that's, I think, why that is there. It's kind of like magic.
It kind of is, right?
You know,
yeah.
When I'm able to look at my part of it and own that, then that resistance isn't there anymore.
Yeah.
Towards that other person.
Mm-hmm. And that's the total deal is getting rid of that resistance. And the more we practice this, because it says we're practicing it, right? So the more we practice this, the quicker we can see it like that. And that's the beauty of it too, that when I can directly see, wait a minute, maybe my tone was wrong when I responded, and that's why they responded like this, instantly goes away, because I'm not the victim anymore. Now I have power to change that.
Jill Alcoholic?
Yeah.
I was just going to add to that. I was just thinking that it says we attract spiritually sick people, right? So when we're acting sick, we're attracting those kinds of people. And I was able to notice that when I did, you know, when I did the 4th step, it's like, you know, yeah, they did stuff, but that's the kind of people that they are. And those are the kind of people I put myself around because I was similar to them, you know? Like you just said, that word react, you know? It's like they might have reacted because you did something as well. So, like you said, the only power in it, I work with kids, and I always say you cannot control what other people do. You can only control what you do. But I said, no. There's no but. Like, you can only control what you do. So it doesn't matter what they do, you know? And that's like the key to the whole thing.
Right, because it's contagious, and that energy that you're putting out there is catching on to everybody else. So could you imagine how many people's in here tonight? For the recording, there's 530 people here tonight.
Yeah.
No, but for the maybe, you know, 35, 40 people in here tonight, just think about what it would look like if each one of you went to your respective communities and homes and places of work and made an amends with the spirit of love and kindness to two or three people in your home or work. It would change the whole atmosphere. Something would change in there, whether it was with a neighbor or somebody inside your home or your family or your work, whatever it is. And could you imagine if those three people went and made an amends with the spirit of love and kindness to the closest three people in their lives, they're in the program or not, and how that would just, the trickle-out effect that would happen from just making amends, it's huge. If we all just made, you know, I had a sponsor one time, everything I called with was who you're helping, or find something you screwed up on and go make a few amends and call me back in a couple hours. Just go make amends. It'll just make the whole world happy if nothing else. You know? Maybe it'll make those people happy and they'll make amends with somebody else. Because that's the whole deal, is that we're helping other people heal and get well as well, and that's the purpose of it. Okay, what else? Was there any more questions? All right, you can go back to your work, Joel.
The next list that they're asking us to make is it says sexual conduct, but I like to think of it as misconduct. It says on 68, now about sex. The book goes on and on talking about, like, if we're asking other people, like, what our sex conduct should be, you're going to get a variety of options. Like, some people are like, oh, yeah, like, language of love, whatever. Or, like, no, it's evil and bad. Like, it's very, it's kind of like a between you and God kind of thing. But it says on 69, we reviewed our own conduct over the years past. Where had we been selfish, dishonest, or inconsiderate? Whom had we hurt? Do we unjustifiably arouse jealousy, suspicion, or bitterness? Where were we at fault? What should we have done instead? We got this all down on paper and looked at it. And basically they're asking us, like, when have I used this as a manipulation tactic to, like, get what I want or to hurt somebody else or just make myself feel good for that night or that moment or whatever? That's really what they're asking us to look at. Like, I don't particularly care what anyone's personal history is. It's not of any kind of interest to me when I'm doing step work. Like, we need to get through it to look at how are you using that. It says, if that it says, I can't even read. In this way, we try to shape a sane and sound ideal for our future sex life. We subjected each relation to the test. Was it selfish or not? That's really what we're here to look at. We ask God to mold our ideals and help us to live up to them. Like, I didn't ask Robin what my sex ideal should be. I sat down.
Should have.
That's terrible. I sat down with God and I wrote, this is just like a lose-lose situation. I sat down with God and asked God to help me mold my sex conduct and my sex ideals. And I sat down with God and wrote, like, what kind of person would he want me to be in a relationship? Like, how do I think my creator would want me to use my sex powers? It says, we remember that our sex powers were always God-given and therefore good, neither to be used lightly or selfishly, neither to be despised or loathed. So it's like, I had to find this, like, happy medium place. And it says, whatever our ideal turns out to be, we must be willing to grow towards it. So I can't say one thing and do another. Like, integrity is my feet and my mouth doing the same thing. So I can't be telling everybody, like, oh, no, I don't do any crazy stuff. But then I'm, like, creeping on some newcomer in the back. Like, we can't do all that. If I'm going to sit down and ask God to mold my ideals, and I have to ask him, like, help me live up to this. Like, this is the plan, and this is, you know, what you want me to do. Like, help guide me towards that. And, like, we talked about this last week. Like, there have been times I've tried to do crazy stuff, and I get in the car, and I'm like, all right, God, you know, I'll throw you a bone. Like, if this is a good idea, I'm going to go meet this boy. Well, there's construction and the road is blocked and I have to turn around and go home. That literally happened to me. So that's how he helped me live up to them. Like, sometimes I need to be slapped around like that. Really though, stop it. You know, Stacey's so uncomfortable. So it says, in other words, we treat sex as we would any other problem. In meditation, we ask God what we should do about each specific matter. The right answer will come if we want it. God alone can judge our sex situation. Counsel with other persons is desirable, but we let God be the final judge. Because we realize that some people are as fanatical about sex as others are loose, we avoid hysterical thinking or advice. Like, do you ever hear somebody talk about this kind of subject and just doesn't sit right with you? Like, that's just not my truth. It's kind of like that. Like, if I'm connected to God and I get with Him and talk about it with Him and go over the whole thing, then that's just what it is. I really don't like this topic.
I love it.
No, I don't like it at all.
They asked me to do a talk on Valentine's Day the other day, bless you, and we just turned to 6 and 9 and talked about sex. I figured Valentine's Day would be a good time to talk about this. I don't think we talk about it enough, so, but we are unfortunately running out of time. I'll just touch on it real quick. And then what Jules said is so key. She just mentioned how it says, if we wanted to a sound sex ideal list. I think there's a lot of things going on with this, and it does say that it's a between you and God kind of thing. It also says that God will have the final judgment. It's still important that we do it, though. We must make this list. We must write it down. We must discuss it with another human being. We must get honest about it and transparent and see through about it. For me, moving through that fear was huge. But my sponsor talks about, you know, the difference in drinking and dying and getting well and walking the sunlight of the spirit is a difference in talking about all of your misconducts and talking about all of them but one. You know, or not wanting to tell the truth about the underlying passive-aggressive things that I'll do to arouse jealousy or to get attention or whatever that looks like today. I don't want to talk about that. And if I don't talk about it, I can't walk in the sunlight of the Spirit. So we talked about that the other week as well. You can't walk in the sunlight of the Spirit and slime around in the darkness. You just got to pick one. I can't expect to have arrived in the sunlight at last. Here I stand, and I'm sleeping with the married, you know, treasurer guy at the home group, and that was my experience. I tried that for a while. When I came in, they said stick with the people in service, and I said okay. And no, I did. And they stick with the winners, and they're in service. So I go, like, I got in real involved in service, and I slept with everybody in service. And then they said, that's not exactly what we meant by sticking with the people, the winners, and the ones in service. But, you know, I didn't come in with this sound ideal of what it looked like. And so, and I think we talked about this. I go off in this soapbox, and I'll just touch on it real quick. I think we already did. But God is the final judgment. It says that it's between you and God. And it's also okay to talk to newcomers about what's going on and have they written a sound sex ideal list yet and have they done an inventory yet and can I help you? You know, I have no problem taking a new role and just saying, can I help you do some inventory on this? And, you know, because what happens is we're talking about everybody and we're seeing it and not offering our help and how we can help people. And we see, you know, there's predators, there's things that go on, and it's about having a voice and helping where you can be helpful. And I ask God to show me when and where I can be helpfulness to that situation. But that doesn't mean I have to have a blind eye to it. It doesn't mean that, you know, and again, I was blessed by some amazing women of dignity and honor, some amazing women that were able to just take me aside and just say, we don't act like that here. This is a spiritual condition that you're suffering from that manifests itself and is coming out in a way that's seeking attention from opposite sex, and that's just not what we do in Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you want to do some work to look at the root of why that's happening, we can do that with you, but you can't act like that to our husbands or our boyfriends or, you know, you can't, and they would tell me it's not good, it's not healthy, and we want to help you, and we love you, and that's why we want to help you. And I think it's so important that, especially as women, you men might not do this too much of that, but, you know, as women, it's so important that we don't cast judgment upon others, that we come in very sick and then we offer our help.
I'm Jennifer. If you see a newcomer coming in, the person has sex preying on them, and you see one of them constantly does that, what is your responsibility to that? Do you have one? Do you know what I'm getting at?
I do not.
I don't know what you're saying.
Okay. If you're in a home group, see Joe Schmo always hitting on the women,
yeah,
the newcomers, right? aspect. You feel it is your responsibility to the women of the group to talk to him, or is it none of your business?
Personally,
I'm just curious what you girls, like, you know. I mean, you hear a ton of things. I'm just asking.
I think my responsibility is with her.
Right.
How can I help you?
Right.
His deal's none of my business.
I think the opposite.
Right.
I mean, this is such a, like, I mean, personally, it's kind of like an outside discussion, but I would say something to him, like, listen, like, give these girls a chance, like, what are you doing? We can probably talk about it.
We can talk about it after the meeting.
Don't talk about it in front of everybody.
Yeah, go ahead.
I'm Frank, I'm an alcoholic.
Hey. Hey.
You guys rock, man. It's awesome. I like the way you break down the stages going through the fourth step and, you know, preparing for that, you know. And, you know, I don't understand why there's this big shadow over the fourth step, like, oh my God, you know. And it's like, we used to go to a rougher neighborhood half in the bag just to get through the night, you know, than doing a fourth step. And, you know, the explanation of the resentment is, you know, like you said, you know, I want you to act like this. I'm not telling you that's what you need to do, and then you didn't, so you're a jerk off, you know. And I'm spiritually sick. So what this does is this helps me realize some of my shortcomings in a way to look at it. And if I have some faith and I'm willing to be open-minded, you know, I see my way through it. It's fear-based. And I'm scared to move on because I don't want to be a victim, because my anger towards you is my defense. But it doesn't serve me. I keep doing it over and over and over and alienating everybody because nobody in the world behaves the way they should. So, you know, but I can come through that and then, you know, just to be one among many and get along and not judge everybody is so relieving, and it's such a gift, you know, to come through the other side and have that. I just think the way you guys explained it was great. And thank you.
Oh.
Thank you, Frank. Any other questions? I think we're out of time.
Yeah.
Nothing else? We'll close up.
Shut it down.
Shut it down.